Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolokimab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
Hattaday presents, in the red corner, the undisputed, undefeated Weed Whacker Guy. Champion of hurling grass and pollen everywhere. And in the blue corner, the challenger, Extra Strength Hattaday. Eye drops that work all day to prevent the release of histamines that cause itchy allergy eyes. And the winner, by knockout, is Hattaday! Hattaday, bring it on!
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver, and this is the show that looks at business and politics on a wider perspective. And coming up on today's show, the changing face of customer service and why Starbucks won't let you in unless you're a paying customer. What exactly is DeepSeek, and why are some people, like the President of the United States, Donald Trump, so worried about it? Plus, has live golf, after 5 years, ruined the game as we know it? You can, of course, email the show at takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, the world's most famous coffee house, Starbucks, has been for years embracing the culture of people coming in, sitting around for hours with their laptops and kind of using it effectively as an office space. They were kind of lax about it for quite a few years, particularly at off-peak hours. But all of that has changed in the last few days as a memo has gone out to the baristas and other staff that they employ to make a subtle but important change that people must buy if they come into the store, otherwise they might be politely asked to leave. So does this make sense for Starbucks, and does it have implications for the wider retail and hospitality sector? So to tease out some of these issues, somebody who knows the sector better than almost anyone is Gene McCabe, who is the CEO of Retail Excellence Ireland. You're welcome to Taking Stock, Gene.
Thanks a million, Emmett.
Thanks for joining us. As I said, Starbucks, they get a lot of attention. They're one of those really visible companies all around the world. Obviously, a big network here in Ireland. I'm sure you've done it. I've done it, even though I don't even drink coffee, which is sit around Starbucks with your laptop or your phone. You're too early for a meeting, or you've missed the meeting, or you're too late, etc. And you use their facilities and so on for probably a longer time than usual. They seem to want to change that. Do you think it makes sense? And why do you think they might want to do that?
Well, Starbucks kind of pioneered that concept of third place, you know, the space between home and work. And they certainly embraced that community. But I think now it's just gone too far the other way, and it's obviously hurting their profit margin. I don't know if you're aware, but the turning point was back in 2018 when they had an incident in Philadelphia where two men were arrested in store, and it kind of set a major crisis for Starbucks. And that's when they came in with that concept of embracing all people within the premises, regardless whether you're a customer or not. So for Starbucks, they have seen their profits drop. They've decreased 5% across North America in 2024. And I think they're expecting a big drop in Q1 of this year. So it's about recalibrating into what is core to the business. And that's customers number one, and making sure it's an enjoyable space for them to be in, but also to spend some money in.
And Gene, just talk to me more wider. We don't want to pin everything about this issue on Starbucks, even though they're sort of a bellwether. But people who come into various cafes, we have them littering Dublin all over the place, no pun intended. And in terms of the people who come in, they might buy, they might not buy, they might buy very minimal something, just a bar of chocolate or something like that, or a pastry. Do stores and hospitality venues really, you know, are they almost going to cause themselves more problems by trying to implement such a policy?
I think there's certainly a difference around cultural norms in different countries. And I also think there's, you know, for any business, there's a fine line to be thread between welcoming all customers in, understanding maybe the moment that that customer's having, whether it's waiting on somebody, as opposed to initially dictating that they need to buy something before they even get to sit down in the likes of a casual coffee shop. But for any business, and especially now when the cost of doing business is so high, and it's all about turning those table overs and maximizing out on that turnover and making sure you're generating revenue. So for look, it's about using a bit of discretion when you are dealing with customers and how they're using their spaces, and that people aren't taking advantage completely of the hospitality.
Yeah, I suppose there's two groups here. One is people who just come in and don't buy anything and go. And then there's what I would call the dawdlers, people who are sort of there on the one small cup of coffee sipping for quite a while, maybe using the Wi-Fi, etc. I suppose stores maybe are less worried about that second group, but I don't know. You tell me.
Look, at certain times of the day, those second groups are an issue. If it's lunchtime and you have someone taking a table up that could be turning you over two lunches and two desserts, you certainly don't want them sitting there drinking a cup of coffee for that period. I don't think anyone in hospitality has an issue when the store is quiet and someone spends a bit longer dwelling, whether they're on their laptop with their coffee. But during peak trade, when tables and capacity is full, you certainly want to see those tables trading over. And it's just about consumers being conscious of that also. I think there's a space for both types of users in hospitality and in coffee shops. But it's during those times, peak times, that the businesses need to be considered, or people need to be considered, of how businesses need to turn over those tables during peak trading hours.
And what does your gut instinct tell you about the implementation of this in an Irish context? You know, how do you think the reputation of Starbucks would fare, I suppose, if they do this in the Irish stores? Do you think it'd be different to the US, or what does your own retail experience tell you on that?
I certainly think Starbucks embraced this concept wholesale at a different scale, and culturally it's become embedded in what they do, and just kind of almost people are not as conscious about utilizing and taking up space when entering a Starbucks in the US and possibly than they would be here. Obviously there is a certain core to people that do take advantage of, you know, sitting around their coffee and their laptop for a few hours. But I think culturally we certainly would be more conscious here in Ireland than we would others. And certainly in smaller cafes, you'd like to think that people are considered, that the owner has bills to pay at the end of the day, and they need to see their tables turning over.
And also I suppose there's the counterintuitive one. I'll see how this settles with you, but if you go into an empty place, a restaurant, a cafe, the owner tends to stick you and the other person you're dining with in the front window to give the effect that, oh, this place is, you know, there's a few customers here, right? So in some ways, the dawdlers might not be the worst thing. They are, you know, they're sort of almost like the mannequins in the window. They're sitting there, people going by, because nobody wants to go into an empty, atmosphere-less venue. So they might serve a purpose in a way.
Absolutely. To a certain extent, there's a happy medium to be reached here. And you're right. You know, we nobody likes to go into an empty premises. Everyone wants to go into a place with a good vibe. But there is a fine line to be thread between creating that atmosphere and also creating a turnover that will keep those doors open.
Now, obviously, Starbucks is not just about people sitting down. It's also about creating a kind of a social ambience, if I can use that phrase. You know, kind of people sitting around, all that sort of cafe culture going right back to, you know, centuries ago in Paris and all these places. I mean, is that possible to get that again? Is that where the company has gone wrong, that they're so obsessed with getting customers through the door, they've lost that little intangible piece of people sitting around, meeting, conversation, etc., which a coffee house is meant to be about? Do you think they might have lost sight of that with this absolute, you know, focus on the bottom line and getting people through the store in and out quickly?
I think Starbucks had gone to the other extreme, where it had become almost like a train station in and out for people who weren't really engaging in purchasing anything or even engaging in a proper coffee culture, which is about, you know, having coffee, catching up with friends, enjoying that experience. I don't think Starbucks has any issue with that. That's what they want to embrace. It's, I suppose, a blatant disregard for the fact that it is a business and that you need to engage with it as such, i.e. buy something, have a coffee, grand open your laptop for an hour or two. But I think it's the more transient aspect of people coming in out the door, just using facilities and taking up space. I think that's where the issue lies. And look, you will always get a certain percentage of customers that might dwell a bit longer and that you might not want to sitting down for half the day on their laptop. But I think it's more the blatant disregard for it that Starbucks has the biggest issue with.
Now, Gene, when we look back at cities here in Dublin, cities in Ireland, including Dublin, the issue is obviously sometimes homeless people will come in to get some warmth and so on and so forth. That causes a problem for owners who, for whatever reason, they want them to be moved out or moved on. Obviously, Starbucks isn't responsible for curing America's homeless problem, but it does land on their door. What could you say are in that sensitive area where there's people often in distress, down on their luck, coming in to get a bit of warmth? It puts the retailer in an awkward spot on a number of fronts, doesn't it?
Yes, but at the end of the day, we're all human and, you know, those incidences will happen, and I think you have to approach it in a, yeah, there is a balance to be made, of course. And look, you know, you are running a business at the end of the day at the same time, so there is a fine line to be tread, but it's always a hard situation in anyone being put in a position like that.
Yeah, and you've got labour unions in the US saying that they don't want their members who are baristas in these hundreds of stores all across America having to enforce this new idea, and they don't feel that their wages are reflecting how you're taking on what could be a fairly onerous responsibility on a daily basis of kind of patrolling the store and so on. They want to see that reflected in higher pay or changing conditions. So it could be awkward just getting staff locally on the ground to implement something like this.
Again, I think the word policy and regulation is just, I hate the words because they rule out the opportunity for people to use a bit of discretion and use their cop on and human instinct to make a decision.
You're talking my language here, Jean. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry, but it does. And it's like, you know, you have to make a call based on all the factors in that moment of whether it's the right thing to do or not the right thing to do. And just because a policy says it is or isn't, sometimes you are doing the wrong thing just to reinforce that policy or regulation. It drives me mad. We're gone past the day where, you know, there isn't a rule, a black and white rule. And, you know, sometimes you have to operate in the grey. And I think we're all better off sometimes when we do operate in the grey because the right decisions are made for the right reasons.
Jean, you'll never survive in a multinational company.
I don't think I'd ever survive in politics either. But, you know, it's a shame we've gone to this space because everyone's afraid if I don't enact the policy, I'll get in trouble. And if I do enact the policy, it's not the right decision, not the right thing to do or not the most humane thing to do. I think, look, if we could get to the space of a bit of cop on and rational thinking and a bit of discretion, we'd be far more better off than this space that we live in of regulations and policies for absolutely every single decision in the world.
I don't know, Jeannie, it might be a political future for you if that's your clarion call. Listen, we have to wrap up soon, but one question I just wanted to ask you while we have the opportunity. How are the first few weeks of the year doing in terms of hospitality, cafes, just while we have you? You know, something we've been hearing a lot about, tough January, so on into February. How's it going out there?
Yes, certainly. It's been a rocky enough start to the year. Feedback was good, in fairness, up to Christmas, and retailers and those in hospitality were quite happy with trade. But certainly January has been a tough month, and it's been quite sluggish start to the year.
No insolvencies or anything like that. So companies are there, they're struggling, but they're surviving. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, look, at your post December into January, you know, you're still living on the cash flow that you made over Christmas. So we'll see what Q1, Q2 brings this year. Hopefully we won't see the same level of insolvency that we saw last year, but it wouldn't surprise me if we do. I know with the new government in place and it not being an election year, we would hope that from a lobbying perspective that there will be more appetite within government to help the hospitality and retail sectors.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. Listen, for the moment, thank you very much. Gene McCabe, who's the CEO of Retail Excellence Ireland. And coming up next, we'll be getting our teeth into deep...
The wrongs we must right. The fights we must win. The future we must secure together for our nation. This is what's in front of us. This determines what's next for all of us. We are Marines. We were made for this.
Hannaday presents, in the red corner, the undisputed, undefeated Weed Whacker Guy! Champion of hurling grass and pollen everywhere! And in the blue corner, the challenger, Extra Strength Hannaday! Eye drops that work all day to prevent the release of histamines that cause itchy allergy eyes! And the winner, by knockout, is Hannaday! Hannaday, bring it on!
Amazon presents Jenny versus the Sun. An absolute gargantuan sphere of scorching plasma. The sun can fry you like a state fair mac and cheese ball.
But Jenny shopped on Amazon and bought 8 ounces of 50 SPF, a beach umbrella, and a large brimmed hat. Hey, son, Jenny just cooked you. Save the everyday with deals from Amazon.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock. My name is Emmett Oliver. Very, very welcome along. And as you know, earlier in the week, history was made as the chip company NVIDIA lost $600 billion on the stock market, the longest single day drop in a day ever. This negative slump was caused in part by the emergence of DeepSeek, a Chinese AI tool, which shocked the Western world as to the extent of, I suppose, China's AI capabilities. But what is DeepSeek and where will it go from here? And how big a threat is it to American technological supremacy? Joining me to discuss this is Ciara O'Brien, who is a business and technology journalist with the Irish Times. You're very welcome, Ciara.
Thanks very much for having me.
Good. Listen, it's been a bumpy week. There has been some recovery in the last few days in NVIDIA shares and some of the other tech stocks. But there's no doubt when this first broke, there was great concern about the leap forward that this Chinese chatbot is able to bring across. Can you just tell us a little bit? I know this is complex stuff, but what is DeepSeek able to do that maybe other chatbots aren't able to do? Or why are people worried about it in the first place?
Well, it's not so much what it can do that others can't. It's the fact that it can do what the others say they can do, but it's done it cheaper and with less power. Because, as you know, all of these companies have been pumping millions and millions into developing models and have, you know, raised billions and have billions upon billions of valuation behind them. But this small Chinese startup has done with about $6 million, they say. They've managed to train an AI that can stand up there with the likes of OpenAI and, you know, it can give you all the answers and do all the reasoning and all of the stuff that you want from AI rather than just a fancy search engine. And it's done it with less power because, as we know, there's been a crackdown on the type of chips and the power of chips that can be exported, say, between the US and China. So they've had to do it with the chips that maybe others wouldn't have considered as useful for this. So they've done it with much cheaper chips, much less powerful chips, and they've done it with less money. So this has caused a massive ripple through the industry because, as you'd imagine, people are always waiting for the other shoe to drop when it comes to new technology. You know, is this going to be all it's cracked up to be? Is this going to be worth what we're pumping into it? And as soon as there's even a hint of something that can do it, I suppose, more cost effectively and more power efficiently, then things kind of get a bit shaken. Now, whether or not that will pan out and whether or not it will be able to do absolutely everything that all these guys are working on, you know, as we've seen, it's not just about reasoning. It's about, you know, being able to create content, say videos and images, and being able to do more complex things and being able to do stuff, say, at an enterprise level for large companies. You know, that still has to be, I suppose, that still has to be figured out. And there's already the kind of the skepticism is starting to creep in. You know, can it actually shake up the industry in the way that?
Yeah, and Ciara, could I ask you about that skepticism? One of the things OpenAI are saying is effectively, and I'm being crude here, but they're saying our material, our programs and so on were copied by this Chinese company. Obviously, there's a longstanding controversy around Chinese products that have counterfeited American technology before. So is that something you think is valid, or would you like to hear more about that? Or what do you think of when that allegation is put on the table?
Well, I think there's a slight bit of irony there because there's lots of people who are commenting on the fact that, you know, this is obviously OpenAI saying, well, our products were used, you know, in some way to train this evidence that they may have been used in some way to train this particular model. But, you know, where did OpenAI get all its training data from? And I believe they're, you know, subject to some copyright lawsuits.
People like yourself, Kira, the Irish Times, and other mainstream media.
Actually, yeah, and the New York Times took a case against them. So, you know, I think there's a little bit of irony there. But look, you know, this is what happens here. This was inevitable. There's always going to be the big flashy technology, and then there's going to be the guys who come after who say, well, we can do it cheaper and we can do it faster. This is the way technology works. That approach won't suit everybody because that approach won't fit with what everybody needs from it. But, you know, I mean, I've been using it for the last couple of days, just asking it random questions. And what I thought was interesting was it showed its work. It showed the reasoning behind it. You know, you could see, you'd ask it a question. You could say, for example, one of the things we asked it was, you know, what does the immersion mean? What do Irish people mean when they're talking about the immersion? What's the obsession?
Tough question, actually, for anyone outside Ireland.
And, you know, I thought, well, this will be one that might stump it because, you know, it is very contextual. But first thing it went to was, well, it could be talking about VR. And you could see all this coming up in the chat window. And I say, wait, actually, hold on. In the Irish context, they could be talking about water heaters. And then it went through all the information that it was going to consider giving me, you know, then talking about the potential kind of cost savings that people could make and, you know, ways they could cut down on their electricity bills by while they're actually using an immersion. And it was funny to kind of see how it went through all that. And then it gives you the answer. And it did the same thing when I asked it, what does an Irish person mean when they say grand? And it went through the dictionary definition of grand and went, well, actually, hold on, it's a colloquialism that Irish people use to mean everything from, you know, I'm fine to I'm mildly exasperated by the disappearing Dublin buses. So, you know, and then it kind of came up with a couple of funny responses. And it was interesting to see that. Now, obviously, a lot of the concentration has been on the fact that this is a Chinese company. It is based in China. Its data is processed on servers located in China. And therefore, if you're using the kind of the DeepSeek app itself, you know, rather than say another take on it, then there are some areas where it won't venture. So I asked it a very innocuous question. Can you tell me about Taiwan? It wouldn't talk about Taiwan at all.
Tiananmen Square massacre. Tiananmen what happened Square. There?
Well, it wasn't. I didn't even ask about the Tiananmen Square massacre. I just asked it to tell me about Tiananmen Square, and it just said it was outside its scope. I did ask it about Uyghur Muslims, and it started to give me a factual answer, and it gave all its reasons, saying, "Well, you know, this they might be talking about statistics, and you know, it's important that I approach this, that we approach this from you know a kind of a factual perspective, because there are obviously yeah." And it just went on and on like that, and then it wrote the answer. And then it deleted it. And I thought there had been a glitch or something. So I went and I asked it again. It did exactly the same thing again. And then it deleted the answer and said it was outside the scope of its abilities and it couldn't answer. Let's answer questions about logic and maths. And, you know, that's...
Yeah, stop talking about this. Stop with this thing over here. You know, it sort of sounds like what it did.
They will all do a certain amount of, I suppose, self-censoring. If you ask about other contentious issues from other AIs, you know, they will approach it from a factual perspective, but they will answer it.
I do like that idea of ideologically or politically driven AI chatbots. I do like that idea. That's probably another discussion for another day. Some other people are also saying, I suppose it's people who have AI money down. They've put investment into this area. So I suppose there's a self-interest there. But just deal with our point for a second, which is essentially if this company checks out and it you know the people look at the system and it's all legitimate and credible and all the rest of it and they've done it with less computing power and less cost and so on, that's a good thing because it means we can all progress AI from here on in. Well, it's not good for NVIDIA etc, but it's good for the rest of us that we can do this for cheaper, we can sort of ramp up AI without spending quite as much money, which means more people can get involved, more companies can get into this area etc, the sort of entry point is lower etc. Do you put any store in that idea at all?
I think we'll have to wait and see. I think, look, this was inevitable, as I said. It's inevitable. Somebody will always come along with a cheaper way of doing something. And it depends on whether or not people will actually get on board with doing that. And, you know, there's various reasons why they may not. They may need something more than this particular model can give. They may need something that has higher power in it. You know, I don't think that NVIDIA is going to drop off the face of the earth altogether because one Chinese startup has come out with a kind of an open AI competitor that could potentially cut into its market. You know, this was always going to happen. And I think that a lot of the drop that we saw in the share price, which, as you said, it has recovered quite a chunk of it, but a lot of the drop that we would have seen would have been from people maybe who were looking to take money out anyway, and they're looking for any excuse to kind of go, right, well, that's us out. But what I would say is, you know, it's less about kind of as well the whole US versus China, because there is going to be an element of that creeping into the conversation as well, because, you know, the US has been very vocal about banning foreign controlled apps if they're considered, you know, in the control of their adversaries. We've seen what happened with TikTok in the US. Obviously, that's currently a fluctuating situation, but there are already talk of countries banning DeepSeek because of the potential for, you know, data gathering and all of that stuff. So we're going to see that creeping in.
Can I bring it back to your other favourite topic we discussed on News Talk before, which is Apple. And you might say, well, hang on a second, you're jumping off script here. But what I'm going to connect the two up. AI was meant to go onto Apple iPhones. It went on to some phones in some regions and so on. They had the results the other day, bit disappointing. I got an iPhone 16. I'm still questioning why I made that decision, because I don't see the huge leap forward, but that's just me. Like, with all this AI commentary and so on, and DeepSeek and all the rest, I'm still a bit nervous, apprehensive, and, you know, questioning of, is it coming true at the consumer level? Are we seeing this big AI revolution? And when I mean a consumer level, just for ordinary people, I know it helps enterprises and it drives certain business processes and so on. But are you seeing that? I mean, obviously it's on an iPhone to some degree, and it is on some of their rivals and so on. But are you seeing a big revolution in consumer technology where AI is penetrating, or is that still to come?
I think that is still on the way. I mean, it is starting to filter through. So if you see the most recent generation of Samsung smartphones that were launched in the last couple of days, that ties in AI a lot closer. So the idea is, like, so from a consumer point of view, I want to be able to control any smart home devices I have with simple commands. And without AI, without generative AI, it's a bit more difficult. You have to be very specific about what you ask it to do. So I would like, for example, everything just to work. I want to ask my phone, you know, what appointments I have for the day. And I want it to tell me, but I also want it to tell me how I get there, what time I have to leave at, and do I need to...
I was going to say, what time you would turn the immersion off at.
Exactly.
Go back to earlier conversation.
My AI, my smart home will know when I leave the house to turn the immersion off anyway, because I don't no longer need it. You know, that's the kind of... That's where the real world... application for a lot of people will come in, where it makes your life easier. So I don't think, in terms of kind of like the big bang, I think it's going to be more of a gradual creep for consumers. You know, more and more AI will take over doing little things that we don't really want to do, or we don't know how to do as well. You know, and I found myself using AI for, say, finding, I had a half remembered line from a poem in my head, and I wanted to remember the rest of the poem, couldn't give it any more detail other than these three words that were in it. It found the poem for me. I used Google's Gemini to find the poem. And it gave me a load of suggestions and asked me for a bit more detail. You know, could I tie it down to a particular poet, or could I tie it down to a particular era? And once I got that, it came back with the poem and it was right. Now, it would have taken me a lot longer to find that with a search engine. Again, this was just something random. But now I've found, like, I have two children who now ask me to ask Gemini about different things that they want to know about. So at the moment, they're Minecraft obsessed. They want to know all about these mods in Minecraft. And you asked Gemini, and Gemini...
I'll just pretend I know what you're talking about there.
Exactly. Well, and listen, you can go ask Gemini.
Exactly. That's what I need to do. The other thing I wanted to ask you about as well is the whole competition. Is it likely now, do you expect this is, like, I call it the AI arms race. So each time there's another leap forward, and then we have a slight reversal and one company goes. It's a bit like Russia and the United States competing to land on the moon way back many decades ago. Do you think now the Americans will punch back here? You know, you'll have, whether it's Meta, who are putting a lot of money into this area, Microsoft themselves, OpenAI, you've already mentioned. There are other companies there. We haven't mentioned them yet, but Mr. Musk is also in this space. So do you see in the next few months, the next time we'll be talking to you, oh, X company has come up with another advance again on this large language model area? Or do you think we'd be waiting a while, because these guys from China have made such a leap forward that it'll be a while until somebody is able to press the button again?
I think the work is ongoing in the background all the time. I mean, even as we're talking now, they're developing more advanced models. But I do think that, you know, there's different areas that these are being aimed at. So Microsoft is aiming at a very specific market with its Copilot stuff. It's aiming at Office 365 kind of users of subscribers. It's aiming at making their lives a bit easier. And, you know, the key thing is not just about the technology, but how it integrates, because it's all very well having a very smart AI, but if you don't integrate it into the right applications, as we've seen, you know, you can ask ChatGPT all the questions in the world, but then you just shut it down and go about your business. If it's integrated into your phone, you're more likely to use it. So the key thing is, you know, not just the models and how smart they are, it's about how they can be applied to our daily lives. And that's where I think the leaps are going to come. I mean, like, we've seen so many leaps in the different reasoning of models in the last couple of years. I mean, 2022, don't forget, was the kind of the first time we really started to hear much concrete stuff about generative AI. It was all kind of very... it was all very ephemeral before that. You know, it was something that was coming, but we didn't know when. It's like the constant promises of autonomous cars. You know, we're still waiting essentially for taxis that can drive us around, unless you're in a very specific area of San Francisco.
Yeah, or, and also, yeah. Where does marketing come into this and branding? What I mean by that is, when we had the original revolution of the search engines, you know, a lot of people who were around at that time say, well, actually, if you went back, Google's wasn't actually the best at the time, but they eventually beat off the others, and now they're all effectively gone, right? You have Bing in there as well, right? But is it possible that even though one of them might be slightly better a chatbot than the other one, if you don't know as much about one of them, you might just use the other one? So in other words, eventually these will have to become branded products, and that's a different ballgame. That's not just about technological performance, but about visibility, awareness, and so on. Or do you think, no, it's just simply whatever comes back with the better quality data and answers, that will be the winner?
I think that is a very good point, and it is likely what will happen, because, you know, as I said, if you don't have the right integrations, it's not going to work. So if something is there all the time, you're going to use it. And that's pretty much, I mean, Google, as you said, it's now the kind of the top search engine in the world. It's also a verb. I mean, you don't Bing anything. You do Google stuff, though. You tell people to Google something when you mean look it up online yourself, please, and stop asking me the question. But that's, you know, I do think that, like, people, when people talk about ChatGPT, you know, they could be talking about sometimes almost any AI. It just happens to be that ChatGPT is the most well-known at the moment. So I think, yes, getting that brand recognition is going to be key. How companies go about that, though, will be something else altogether.
Listen, we've got plenty to talk about over the next few months, and no doubt we'll be documenting and chronicling it all. But for the moment, we'll leave it there. Ciara O'Brien, who is a technology and business journalist with the Irish Times, thank you very much for walking us through that. And coming up next, we'll be hearing about what's happening with LIV Golf.
The wrongs we must right. The fights we must win. The future we must secure together for our nation. This is what's in front of us. This determines what's next for all of us. We are Marines. We were made for this.
Hannaday presents, in the red corner, the undisputed, undefeated Weed Whacker Guy. Champion of hurling grass and pollen everywhere. And in the blue corner, the challenger, Extra Strength Hannaday. Eye drops that work all day to prevent the release of histamines that cause itchy allergy eyes. And the winner, by knockout, is Hannaday. Hannaday, bring it on.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Real facts about the 988 Lifeline.
We respect people's confidentiality. People do not need to tell us their name or where they live or where they're at.
Call, text, or chat 988 for free. Confidential support anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
I'm Emmett Oliver, and this is Taking Stock.
Now, 5 years ago, the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund founded a new golf tournament called LIV Golf. Now, over those 5 years, the tournament has rapidly expanded, bringing in a number of high-profile golfers and, of course, media deals. But how is this large-scale investment changing the world of golf 5 years on? To mark that and discuss the wider issues brought to the surface. But this is Ian Mallin, a columnist and reporter with the Irish Examiner, and also Nathan Murphy, who is our own head of content here at Off the Ball. Both of you guys, very welcome.
Good to talk to you.
It's great. And Ian, I'll come to you in a second. And Nathan, 5 years ago, when it first broke this idea, we all talked about sports washing. We talked about the usual issues around the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, what goes on. My sense, and it could be wrong, that they have slightly receded, at least in terms of media visibility, and it's just down to the golf itself and who's playing for who. Am I right in that?
Yeah, it turns out sports washing works, and eventually people get fed up of having the same conversation and the moral outrage that was there when LIV Golf was first mooted and when Phil Mickelson and Lee Westwood and Graham McDowell made that move, and the huge amount of criticism that they received and the questions that they had to answer about the human rights record in Saudi Arabia. Those questions aren't been asked in the same way today of Tom McKibben, who has just announced this week.
He's a young rising star.
From same golf club as Rory McIlroy out of Hollywood Golf Club, who's 22 years of age, has just secured his PGA Tour card, and his career was only going one way, it seemed, and was going to track that traditional route to good European player, good PGA Tour player, into contention at majors, and he has decided to move to LIV Golf, and really brings a degree of uncertainty as to what happens next in his career, because the one thing that has developed over the last 5 years is this massive state of limbo in the world of golf, that nobody quite knows where we are with LIV and the PGA Tour and a very fractured professional golf
okay,
scene.
Ian, can I bring you in on that? I mean, we were told when this was all announced, or certainly in recent years, there's going to be a deal, there's a gap between the two sides, but they'll get there, and Joe Biden and all sorts of people were involved in trying to bring the two sides together. But yet it isn't quite cemented yet. Is it just still arguing over finance and it will happen soon? Or do you think there's something else bigger going on?
The finance is the last thing, actually. I mean, the finance, I believe, and having in conversation regularly with the PGA Tour for briefing and whatnot, the finance was agreed as far back as last August. The big issue for the LIV Tour and any proposed merger or amalgamation with the PGA Tour, as announced a year and a half ago now at this stage, would you believe, is really down to two things, and that's to the players and down to the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice have a problem with a Saudi investor or any foreign investor coming in and buying a US asset, as the PGA Tour is. And the second thing is the players. Players on the LIV side seem to be quite happy the way things are. And why wouldn't they be? You mentioned Tom McKibben there. He got a $5 million signing on bonus already. That's before he plays in any of these $25 million tournaments, which are starting next month. We talk about the rivalry in the Ryder Cup between the US and Europe. The rivalry between LIV golfers and PGA Tour golfers is quite toxic and has come to a head on social media and other areas over the last number of years. So bringing the players together is going to be the key problem. And one of the key problems around that is also that the players on LIV quite like their team event makeup, because for a number of reasons, the captains are quarter owners of each team. Each of those teams now is becoming quite valuable. If you look at Bryson DeChambeau, anytime you see him these days, and he is the most visible golfer on the planet now. He's wearing his Crushers GC cap. And these teams are hugely valuable assets. So to get the LIV golfers want to bring a certain team element into PGA Tour. PGA Tour are resisting that. But really, the Department of Justice is the one who's holding all the cards here by continuing this investigation. See if this would, it would be a merger effectively.
And run that past Nathan. Nathan, are we looking at, I know it's complex and I know there's a lot of big personalities involved, but are we looking at a deal whereby, you know, you get 49, we get 51, we get a revenue split, you get this, we play that. I know it's very complex, but is that ultimately what it's going to look like?
I think what's going to happen is that the Saudis will ultimately get a small percentage of the PGA Tour, and it's going to change from a not-for-profit into a commercial business, and they'll get 7-8%, and maybe there might be a coming together at certain times of the year of the two tours. The main thing that has developed in recent weeks is that while Joe Biden might like golf, Donald Trump loves golf, and he also has no problems cozying up to the Saudis when it in terms of investment. So the expectation is that his arrival will mean
that
the DOJ might suddenly have a different opinion on all of this. But the players' divide is equally as interesting, because it's not just PGA against LIV, it's PGA against PGA. So you've Rory McIlroy, who has been LIV Golf's most vocal critic. The line was, "I hate LIV Golf." And we spoke to Rory a couple of years ago at the Irish Open about this, and he'd softened his stance and he said the world has made up its mind for him in a way that everybody does business with Saudi Arabia. So the PGA Tour are better off in bed with them and taking that investment rather than trying to go to war with them in a race for funding that they're always going to lose. But what you have now is McIlroy on one side of the PGA Tour, who sees this as an opportunity for maybe golf getting out of America. So the PGA Tour spreading its wings. So maybe we'd have an Irish Open where the best players in the world turn up, more of them than just Rory McIlroy, which is what we have. Whereas the best American golfers in the world, well, they have it good, because everybody at the top level of golf is making a lot of money right now, and they don't want to leave America. So even within the PGA Tour, you have a split now as well.
Ian, the bit I don't get, and I bow to you, the superior knowledge of both of you on the golf thing, but I'm seeing figures about golfing viewership figures plunging to the floor, right? And I mean, a lot of people only watch the majors and don't watch the smaller tournaments. So how is golf getting all this money and interest when the actual interest seems to be falling?
Well, revenues in the PGA Tour for last year were about $2 billion, which is still significant, of course. You're right. Viewership is falling, down 20% this year. And I presume, very much like Nathan, I would have sat down every weekend when I got away with it, Sunday evenings especially, to watch the final day of whatever tournament was on the PGA Tour. This time around, and much of last year, I'm not that pushed anymore, because you know it's so fractured. The best players aren't playing against the best players, and those TV audiences are suffering. And also, a number of key investors and key commercial partners have left the PGA Tour. Now, they're very quick to point out always, oh, there's other ones coming in, and there's actually a list of prospective partners coming in. But some of the big money guys are moving, and they're not happy with the. I mean, who would be happy with that niche audience as it is, as a television audience anyway? But with any sort of retraction, it's going to spread.
Nathan, I mean, what I'm trying to say here is in. There's a lot of interest. Everyone wants to buy into golf, but golf is not doing well. There seems a contradiction at that.
Listen, there's a massive contradiction. And we were talking about this in our golf podcast today, that golf has an overstated sense of importance post the Tiger Woods era. Golf was sort of similar to tennis pre-Tiger Woods, in that people were interested 4 weeks a year. Your hardcore were involved at other times, and it had a couple of big stars, but generally...
Like, could the average person, it's a stupid phrase, but could the average person identify Bryson DeChambeau in the street? I know you could.
I often bring this up, the sort of Grafton Street test of, if you walk down Grafton Street, would you be recognised? I don't know if you agree with the scene. There's players in the top 20 of the world, if they walked into a golf club, I'm not sure to be recognised by a lot of people, but all of them are making insane amounts of money. And what LIV have done is forced the PGA Tour to seek outside investment, and they're basically giving money for nothing. They're trying to find ways to give their top players money to just keep them playing. And the viewing figures are falling off a cliff. Like, they're going up against the NFL at the moment, which is an impossible task. I think the viewing figures for the NFL last week were 57 million. The viewing figures for the PGA Tour were in around 400,000. So it's hard to see how the prize money is in any way sustainable unless they have the bottomless pit, or, well, what once was the bottomless pit of the PIF.
But doesn't that hand an advantage to the players? They can say to PGA, if you don't like what I'm charging or what I'm getting and all the rest, I'll head off to the LIV people.
That's
so it's forcing new money in there. That's kind of artificial.
Yeah, that is what they've done, isn't it, Ian? That, like, Rory McIlroy has stayed. And so John Rahm went for somewhere between 400 and 600 million to LIV Golf. Rory McIlroy would have been worth that at least. Tiger Woods, the talk at the time was 800 million to sign for LIV. He stayed. So the PGA Tour have come up with all sorts of equity programs. They've this PIP fund where its most famous players get 10, 20 million just for being and just for staying on the PGA Tour. And again, the obsession with money in professional golf, I think, has done huge damage to people's interest levels. The PGA Tour have gone down the route of saying, well, this tournament is worth 20 million, so you should be interested in it. But the problem is the players win it and they're nonplussed because they all have so much, it doesn't really matter. So we are in a scenario where we're back to really the four majors a year where it's not about the money, it's about the prestige, and they are the four tournaments where all of the best players in the world are now together.
And Ian, is that the problem? It's almost too competitive golf. Every tournament is won by someone else and a fresh face comes along who nobody's ever heard of. Next tournament, another fresh face comes along of nobody people have heard of. Is that a problem coming contrasting with the Tiger Woods era where everyone knew this particular individual?
It's an enormous problem, apart from the majors where you'll still have the big guys contesting against each other. And by the way, the figures for the Masters last year in the US were down considerably, down to the lowest they have been in over 10 years. So, but even still, you know, in relation to who's playing every weekend, who cares? Nobody cares anymore. It's almost like...
Hey, steady on, we've got to do an item here on this scene. You know?
I've got to do a golf podcast every week.
I mean, as an avid golf fan, I'm not that pushed. I will possibly watch some other sport, the NFL or whatever, last weekend as opposed to what was happening at the golf. I mean, you're looking at a real big problem now when the audience is turned off. But I think what might happen in the next year, and this is what a lot of the chatter is this week and last week in the States, is that Liv came in as a disruptor. They wanted a piece of golf, and they have certainly disrupted, and they're the winners here in a big way. But there's speculation now rising that they may come in and make a bid for the DP World Tour, because as you probably know, Emmett, I know Nathan does, if you're playing the LIV Tour, you cannot get world ranking points. So these golfers are not ranked, even though they're the very best. Bryson DeChambeau, possibly the best golfer last year, along with
Scotty. Okay, well, Nathan is going to have to decipher all this. DP World, a lot of our listeners will say,
DP World are the sponsors, and they want their pound of flesh when we're talking about the European Tour. So now, the European Tour, again, it's very complicated. I understand for people who don't follow golf, the European Tour are in a strategic alliance with the PGA Tour, but they're very much the poor relation of that. And that's where the opportunity maybe comes for the PIF to go and buy the European Tour. Again, from a purely golfing point of view and a sports point of view, that would be of benefit to Ireland, because the Irish Open is almost solely reliant on Rory McIlroy turning up every year, and there was a year where he didn't, and the whole ecosystem around it nearly collapses. He's committed to coming to the K Club this year, but you could end up with a scenario where that event becomes bigger because of that. But do you want that because of the moral questions that are there about where the money is coming from?
Those moral questions, just coming onto that for a second, can I ask you a little bit more, broadening this out a bit into the Saudi part? The strategy, the sports washing, what they're doing. We see them, you know, obviously upping the game in terms of football. Steven Gerrard has just been sacked. It doesn't seem to have worked out too well for him, but I'm sure he's banked a lot of money. We see, you know, Vinicius Jr. could go there, who's a sort of a younger player, which is not just the guys getting their pension, etc. So what are the Saudis doing? Obviously, golf is big, football is big. There's even a little bit of sniffing around the rugby area at this stage. So are you detecting a strategy here, or is it just we're doing the golf thing, but in a few years we might forget the golf thing and fly off over to this area? Or is it just they're gobbling up everything? Or from the Saudi perspective, what do you think their strategy is?
Well, golf marked a change in the strategy. So what had been happening was they were investing in clubs within sports. So Newcastle United would be the most famous one in this part of the world.
And with the boxing going on there constantly,
exactly.
Right?
Whereas golf, they went after the entire sport. They tried to buy the entire sport. And while right now it seems implausible that they would be able to buy the Premier League or the NBA, there is this insatiable demand for more and more money from all of the competitors that quite simply the organizations can't keep up with. Now, the PIF, it seems, are going to take a different strategy, and there may not be the endless pot of money that was there 12 months ago, and they're reimagining what the next 10, 20 years looks like. So maybe it's all going to settle down a little bit. But yeah, people look at it in two different ways. One is the obvious one of sports washing, that this is a country that has a horrible human rights record and that they are using these events so people look at the country more favourably. Other people think there is a longer term strategy of eventually the oil is going to run out and they need to have an economy in place as that happens. They have a very, very young population. They want entertainment. They need to keep that population quite happy to make sure the status quo remains in place. That's maybe the nicer way of looking at it.
But they're spending all this money
washing.
And they're getting the sports watching, but they're not developing, from what I can see, any of their own athletes. I mean, you could be correcting me now, but is there brilliant Saudi golfers that are going to start? So in other words, it's not going into developing their own.
I don't know, Ian, you might know more. I don't think there's too many opportunities in the world of golf for young Saudis.
Yeah, so in other words, in other words, it's purely about TV rights, etc., etc. That's it. It's not as if they're developing the game or developing Saudi footballers.
It's all about engagement, Emmett. And you mentioned strategy a couple of times there. And whilst it is tempting to think, oh, they just throw all this money at something, and they you know, everything that the Saudis or the PIP fund, you know, remember the PIP is worth about what we think it's about 620 billion. I think that's a conservative estimate. But
so this is the main vehicle the Saudis are using, just for our listeners' benefit, yeah.
For future investment, because the oil is going to run out at some point and they will need something to fall back on. But I mean, it's not just sport. If you look, they own 40% of Selfridges. They're acquiring all the time. Everything is strategically linked. They're the biggest threat to Silicon Valley in the world because they're developing tech vehicles and parks over there that will be better and bigger than the US. I mean, everything, and I spoke to some people who work within the Saudi ecosystem, and they say, look, there's no, you know, easy money over there. You can't just go over and everything is just, oh, well, we'll throw money at that one. Everything is strategically aligned and strategically linked, and particularly LIV Golf. And you know, whether that's to get engagement, it certainly, as you say, not to promote its own diaspora or its own population, but it's all about engagement and it's all about visibility. That in turn goes back to what we call sports washing. And as Nathan pointed out at the very beginning, you know, we kind of have almost forgotten about the moral side of this, and that's a terrible thing. From that, we should all feel a little guilty about that too. But that's the effectiveness of what the Saudis.
Okay, well, there's an old phrase: morality is done in a different room, and maybe we need to get into that other room. Listen, we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for walking us through. It's going to be an interesting few years. And Nathan Murphy, who's head of content here at Off the Ball, and Ian Mannin, who's a columnist on business and sport at the Irish Examiner. Thank you very much for coming in the conversation. That's it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I just remind you, of course, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Ben Sweeney. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Hannaday presents in the red corner the undisputed, undefeated Weed Whacker Guy. Champion of hurling grass and pollen everywhere. And in the blue corner, the challenger, extra strength, Hannity! Eye drops that work all day to prevent the release of histamines that cause itchy allergy eyes. And the winner, by knockout, is Hannity! Hannity, bring it on!